who, like me, have come to realize that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they have become counterproductive. I'm Yada. Our number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, at the conclusion of our first hour, we were discussing the fall of Ramadi. The fall of Ramadi is significant for a number of reasons. One is the Islamic State is able to hold territory and able to fight on two fronts simultaneously. And the more the United States bombs them, the more effective they seem to be. The Islamic State, since we took out what we called a relatively high person with a boots-on-the-ground raid, and the second-in-command with the bombing of a mosque, which is hard to explain when you say you're not at war with Islam, and that the Islamic State's not Islamic. They have captured Palmyra, and they have captured Ramadi, while they're holding Mosul, the second-largest city in Iraq, all while the United States is conducting massive numbers of bombing raids. We made a bad situation worse. That's the bottom line here. And the more we escalate our war against the Islamic State, the more effective the Islamic State becomes. It is also material because by capturing Ramadi, the Islamic State hugely increases its arsenal of heavy weaponry, because the forces America was allegedly training to protect Iraq left, and they left all of their war material that America had provided behind. So now the Islamic State is much more heavily armed. It is meaningful because of the fact that it caused another refugee crisis, this time with the Islamic State killing the refugees from behind as they flee, and America's supported militias and government troops with American weapons killing them as they try to immigrate into Baghdad. No matter how you look at it, it's meaningful, but it's especially meaningful recognizing that the only way that there is any chance of recapturing Ramadi is to deal with a devil worse than the Islamic State. That's Iran. It's the Iranian defense minister that is orchestrating the counteroffensive. And all of the troops, no matter if they're government troops or militias, are loyal to Khomeini in Iran. And so America now is relying on, is equipping, is working with a devil worse than the devil that we went in to subdue. You can't win in that kind of a scenario. All you can do is make things worse. And yet, all of the side rhetoric on this is Republicans condemning the Obaminator for allowing this to happen when the Republicans won't accept any of the blame. This occurred because of the stupidity of us invading Iraq in the first place. That was a war that, as it wore on and we realized that we made a bad situation worse, when it became obvious, we never accepted that reality, but we did. We made a bad situation much worse in Iraq, that we caused this problem by sending our troops then through shock and awe and then through ground troops. And now the Republicans are saying the only answer is we've got to send ground troops in. Well, we did that. That's what created the Islamic State. The Islamic State in Iraq didn't exist before America sent in ground troops. They were a direct response to our ground troops. And then when we gave the country to the Shias and therefore to Iran, the Iranians, with our weapons, started to pummel the Sunnis. So America provided, through the Awakening Program, weapons for the Sunnis. And then as the Sunni militants spread across the border into Syria and began to fight Assad. America provided weapons for the same Sunnis to fight on that side of the border. And now those weapons are being brought to bear against the Shiites in Iraq, because the Shiites in Iraq have been tormenting and torturing and terrorizing the Sunnis, all with American weapons. We made this mess as a direct result of our intervention. And now the Republicans are talking about, well, the solution is we need to go back. Now, there's not a single one of them that says we need to go back and establish democracy in Iraq. Not a single person wants the country built in Iraq. Why? We broke it. We can't fix it. At least we know that now. Nobody wants the country built, but they want to defeat the Islamic State. Oh, Islamic State, bad. Got to defeat them. The only thing Americans seem to understand, it's no longer words. It's no longer evidence. It's no longer reason. You don't want to think through cause and consequence. You don't want to understand past history. No, all we seem to know is we got a shiny new military. Lots of fancy toys. Let them go in and kill them. But how do you kill the Islamic State? How would you do that? What are you going to, you're going to go into Iraq again and take on the Islamic State in Iraq? How are you going to know who's part of the Islamic State and who's not? How are you going to know between the Sunnis that you're allegedly fighting on behalf of and against, and the Shias that you're partnering with? How do you know who's the bigger devil? Who's your enemy? Everyone? Then are you going to go into Syria? Are you going to fight a war against the Islamic State in Syria? Are you going to fight a war against Assad in Syria, or both in Syria? Or are you going to fight a war against Hezbollah in Syria? What are you going to do there? What are you going to do once you leave? Once you break it? Are you going to go to Libya, where the Islamic State is taking over city after city? Are you going to go to Nigeria, where Boko Haram has aligned itself with the Islamic State? Are you going to reinvade Afghanistan because the Taliban now has aligned with the Islamic State? What are you going to do? Glenn, what do you think?
Yeah, good morning, Anna. I have a wonderful little box of toys to dump on the desk to shoot a picture, but before I do that, I'll answer what you're talking about here. This all seems to make sense to me. I understand, you're reviling the West, and I think the West is going to continue to behave in an ineffectual, piecemeal manner. It shows the superiority of overwhelming numbers of boots on the ground, against technology. I mean, it reminds me of Top Gun, where, they teach the pilots dogfighting because they become too dependent on the standoff technology and missile.
Oh, you're right.
And in this particular case, we have a military that, and I've been saying this now for 10 years, America has a military that is designed for a foe that does not exist. It's a foe that will never exist. We have a military that's designed to fight an invading country that's highly technological, like the Russians or Chinese. But the Russians and Chinese have no interest and no capability and will never have an interest or a capability for invading America. So what is our military for? We can't use our military against an enemy that doesn't wear uniforms, that doesn't use sophisticated weaponry.
Since the playing down of the superior navy and the nuclear missiles, mm-hmm. especially the Cold War stuff, we also have a military that's been geared toward using small numbers of elite troops and high-tech weaponry and air power for fomenting and prosecuting proxy wars. And overthrowing dictators. But then what?
It's this idea that you overthrow Saddam Hussein because he was a bad guy. So yeah. Then what do you get?
It's an empire that doesn't have legions of occupation.
Well, of course.
Fort Dix Army Post in New Jersey used to have a picture in the main building where you walk in that had a picture, a famous picture of an infantryman laying down, you know, helmet, uniform, rifle, right, lying down, prone position, and it was labeled the ultimate weapon. You know, this was an army infantry training.
Right, of course.
And it's like, so, yeah, this little empire of ours wants to break things up and use high tech, but it doesn't have overwhelming numbers of troops on the ground to occupy. And that's precisely
let's say that we used a blend of high tech in your superlative troops to go conduct the raid well inside Syria to get a somewhat high up military and economic attaché for the Islamic State. Do you know what that raid would have cost us and what the value was to the Islamic State of the person captured? I mean, that's kind of like what we did with our cruise missiles when we were beginning to fight Al-Qaeda. We would deploy, you know, $50 million worth of cruise missiles from billion-dollar warships. And we would, you know, we would absolutely destroy some tents, and I'm sure some camels took the worst of it. But I mean, it's how do you win? It was like Vietnam. You know, every battle we fought, we went broke.
Well, this is what, you know, flagging empires do. You know, they get themselves spread too thin, and oh great, I now have a noise in the background. This is what flagging empires do. They get themselves, they're corrupt, their leadership becomes corrupted, they become too far afield, through Roman legions and stuff, start to suffer defeat. We are precisely in the position of a flagging empire.
Right. You know? Totally corrupt from within. Greed and all manners of internal dishonesty and thievery and graft from within. No moral compass anymore. And in just a whole show of let's rattle this saber so that we can pretend that we're still a superpower without any thought about what the consequence is going to be or what the failure was the last time we rattled the saber.
Right. Now, knowing what we know about where things are inevitably going to go from the store, I'll finish this. I'll start this when we get back.
Okay. But here we are again. You know, we're partnering with a demonic enterprise, Shia Islam, to fight Sunni Islam, not recognizing that 80% of Muslims are Sunnis, and that there is a 0% possibility that the Shias will prevail, or that we would even want them to. Yeah, so here we are, and with Iraq having imploded, having become worse than anyone had ever envisioned it could possibly become, and having not one politician, not one State Department attaché, not one ambassador, not one military leader, officer, capable of explaining what went wrong, how we got ourselves into this mess, because all of the diatribe now out of political candidates and out of the military is to repeat the same mistakes we made previously.
You know, Yada, I noticed you used the first person plural reflexive pronoun we.
I would suggest
that one of the reasons I am less frustrated by you about these things is that I do not identify with this the culture in this regard. I identify my citizenship is not of this world.
And I
know what they're gonna do, so I'm not gonna make myself crazy because I know how they're gonna behave. So why should I get myself frustrated about it?
That's true. It's one thing to have become anti-political and anti-religious and anti-patriotic and anti-military and realize that all of these institutions are counterproductive. But it's another thing entirely to completely disassociate oneself from one's citizenship. So it is in the place where I reside. So it's difficult. It's difficult to eliminate the first person plural reference to. And I don't even know if I'm using it in terms of America or Western civilization or humankind at large. I mean, I think it works just as well if the we is we as humankind, we as, as governments, we as the West, we as America. Yeah, it's all fitting.
We also know that even collectively in that sense, we are not going to change them. You know,
that's correct. We aren't.
But,
Kiyosha realized that, I'm certain that he realized that he was not going to change the politicians and the fundamentalist religious types that he assailed in Matanyahu, Matthew 23. It didn't stop him from exposing and condemning them in great detail.
He spent his time We're exposing and condemning the corrupt religious of his own people. He didn't spend precious little time referencing Rome at all. The way was born as a persecuted movement among subjugated people within an empire. And he spent precious little time commenting on the empire at all.
Has an enormous amount of prophecy where he spends about a quarter of his testimony through the Torah and prophets is about the corrupt nature of human institutions, political, religious, Babylon is the principal whipping boy, because Babylon is really the genesis of all of these beasts. They trace their heritage back to Babylon. So it has a lot to say about him.
It's the paradigm of corrupt government. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
I think the reason he does that, and the reason he's it isn't a coincidence, Glenn, that Yahweh told Abraham that if he wanted to be part of his family, of his covenant, and to join him in a relationship, that the first thing he would have to do is leave his country. And it's not a coincidence that the country that he was in was Babylon.
Right.
And it's not a coincidence that Babylon is used by Yahweh to describe why he hates religion and politics, military schemes.
Right. If we think about to what are we called in terms of perhaps activistically opposing this wickedness? You look at what really intelligent, really moderate, reasonable, moderate men, people who advocate truth, who pit themselves against this sort of thing, where do they end up? Guys like Ron Paul, guys like Ross Perot, anybody who advocates sanity, moderation, truth, reason, is marginalized, kicked to the curb, vilified, demonized, and possibly even killed.
Yeah. So, but you look at Ron Paul, who spent a lifetime as a libertarian, but within the Republican Party as a libertarian. When he gives a speech at a university, the attendance is usually significant, and he's reasonably compelling in his arguments. But he is absolutely part of the system. He is a congressman. His son is a senator. They are absolutely integrated within the problem, and they're trying to solve the problem from within. It's not possible.
Right. The problem's not going to be solved. We know that.
No, it isn't. Yes, there is a substantial difference between the Rand Pauls of the world, who are part of the system and who are campaigning from the fringes of the system to fix the system, that want to be elected to oversee the system, and those of us who recognize that we should disassociate with the system because the system is counterproductive, the system is hopelessly flawed, and that there is no way to fix the system, nor is the system worth our time and energy. But most important of all, we can't be part of that system as a major contributor to it, as a player within the system, and be part of the covenant. And I'd rather be part of the covenant.
Right, and it's fair play to it's fair to decry the wickedness, but it's pretty hard to receive and dwell in the shalom of Yahweh if you are exerting your own efforts to vex yourself when you could be resting in Him.
That's the reality, is that there has never been a patriotic Babylonian in the covenant. There has never been a patriotic Greek in the covenant. There's never been a patriotic Egyptian or Roman in the covenant. You can't be part of Yahweh's family. You can't engage in a relationship with him. You cannot be saved and be political or patriotic. I mean, it's a they are completely separate sets. So there's those who are political, those who are patriotic, those who are pro-military, those who are religious, but they are wholly and completely and forever estranged from God. It's your choice.
If you could give me a little extra leash for a minute, let me dump a little things out here, because I have a definite purpose in what I'm doing here. What I'm really addressing is our own the psychology of dealing with all that's going on, and you know how we should think about things. Like for example, so for starters, we know that the governments are going to behave ineffectually against ISIS and all this stuff. We know that this will ultimately result in some sort of global coalescence of Islam to the point that it will result in the Magog battle. So we know that's going to happen over a period of years.
That is exactly what's going to happen.
So we know it's now, along the way, we're on a day-to-day basis, the average narcissistic American is watching the news and getting, like, we'll get news fatigue about Ramadi this day, Tikrit that day, Palmyra another day. It's like, oh, I'm really sick of hearing about it. I don't even know where these cities are. You know? So people are you know, over the long term, until the financial implications are biting them right in their own butts, they're not going to care. And, you know, so unless they're suffering.
The only thing that actually bothers them is not the fall of Ramadi, that meaningless to them. What's meaningful is when someone like the Islamic State is kidnapping little girls and using them as sex slaves, or the Boko Haram is doing so, or the individual decapitation of a single person, when they see or exposed to that, they have an emotional hit that probably lasts an hour or two.
And the fact that Mexican mothers in the streets of Mexico City are pimping their own daughters, you know, doesn't bother them unless maybe they would go down and see it as a tourist. So it's not just the Muslims. These travesties are happening all over the world. Okay, now, for my little apocalyptic dump. So we know that ultimately we're going to see, you know, God's stated prophecies fulfilled about all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what's going to happen. Okay,
right.
However, so now I want to put out this thing with the fatigue, the apocalyptic speculation. I think there's a sense in which apocalyptic speculation can almost be like a fatalistic, you know, people view it as like a fatalistic snow day, you know, like, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Okay. You know, like in other words, like the ultimate escapism, twisted escapism of like, it could all just be over. And in that vein, I wanted to point out that there are several apocalyptic theories making the rounds right now. In other words, this has to do with the fact that we actually have to hang in for now. There's a lot of stuff to be gone through yet. But the apocalypticism would actually offer like this twisted false hope of escaping it because that's all going to just end anyway. And then
you get your bunker, you get your body armor, you get your special what do they call it? Ghost AR-15. I mean, you get all your weapons, you get your body armor, you get your bunker, freeze dry food and your water filter, and you're just going to be just fine. You're going to survive it. No, you're not.
Great. So I'm not going to have to worry about my credit cards or the electrical, and it looks like this whole system's going to crash, and I'm going to be off the hook because it's all going to crash. There's this huge September 23rd thing going around right now about
what's that?
What's that?
Oh. And September or November 23rd? Which day should we mark?
No. It's the fourth blood moon on the Day of Atonement, September 23rd.
Oh, great. The blood moons, the blood moons again. What a farce.
And plus, that has just been trumped recently. There's another, you know, false prophet crazy guy who's saying that the San Andreas is going to blow on the 28th, you know.
Oh, okay.
My point is...
By the way, the San Andreas is going to blow. There's no question about it. Because no one can predict it. It will happen. So what? Right. It's going to happen.
Well, Well, wait,
who
exactly,
cares?
What I'm getting at is the overall psychology of orienting ourselves to a reality-oriented time frame of living with Yahweh in light of what we know from what he said in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and remaining grounded in a world going increasingly mad, whether it's the madness of politicos who are destroying economies and killing people and doing wars over time, whatever it is. About the point is, we have to remain grounded in a realistic attitude.
Right.
Living.
I agree.
And then the question becomes, how shall we then live? How shall we then live?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
because the next 11 years are going to be a roller coaster. There'll be a lot of bad things happen. In terms of these idiots that are trying to predict the days that meteors are going to hit because of blood moons, I mean, all a blood moon is a full lunar eclipse. Full lunar eclipse, happen multiple times almost every year. And there are years where there are two and then more of them. It's natural phenomenon. There is nothing to a blood moon other than a natural phenomenon. The bending of the... the bending of light.
Right. We were sold this, people were selling their wares out there, hawking books and stuff, about four blood moons last year, and this year three of them yielded nothing. The fourth is coming. It's the only one going to be visible in Jerusalem. So all the chips go down on this, and like Y2K or whatever, it comes and goes. And
So this one, God's going to be right one time in four? That's not the God I know. Yeah, that's not the God I know. And, of course, I did three or four shows on the Hagee was one of the big promoters of the blood moons, and I did several shows just mocking it. I mean, it was just the most ludicrous presentation in the world.
Right.
But most of these kinds of things are snake oil. They're verbal snake oil. They're religious snake oil. Listen. You and I know what's going to happen. We don't know the dates that everything is going to happen. There will be an asteroid strike. It's Apophis. It's in the midpoint of the tribulation. I'm not going to be here to see it happen, but it's going to be on April 13 of 2029. It's going to happen. It's not an earth-ending, life-ending event, although it will be catastrophic. We know that. We know there are going to be an increasing number of earthquakes. We're witnessing that, both in magnitude and in frequency, just like birth pangs. We know that there's going to be an increase in terrorism. We've been told that. We're witnessing it. We know that Damascus and Syria is ultimately going to fall. And we know that Israel is going to be sacrificed. And we know that that sacrifice is going to work exactly like Neville Chamberlain's sacrifice of Czechoslovakia worked with Adolf Hitler. We've been told that. So we know what's going to occur. But knowing what's going to occur doesn't stop us from living our lives. It doesn't stop us from warning people. It's just that it does stop us from trying to prevent it.
Right.
It does stop us from trying to protect ourselves from it.
And we're still called, to be responsible, clear-headed, level-headed, enduring, all these things. And that's what I'm trying to get, my thing is, I see this twistedness of people viewing apocalyptic, like a snow day from school. It's like, the ultimate snow day. I'm off the hook from taking my final because there's a snow day. Woo-hoo!
The reality is it's so pervasive because it's going to begin with a combination of so many things. It's the militarization of national security forces like we're witnessing in America, the blending together of military like Homeland Security and the U.S. military, where the U.S. military is now via Homeland Security dealing with Americans in terms of its war material and its deprivation of freedoms. And then you're going to see it, the courts become completely corrupt, and you're going to see all digital control over people, where between your cell phone and your credit card, they're going to know exactly where you are, and they can not only stop you from doing anything, stop your car from running, stop your phone from working, stop your credit card from working, wipe out your bank account, take away your home. Not only can they do all of those things to you, they can actually set you up to make you look like a criminal and then prosecute you on fake charges. You know, we've already lost, and we've lost on so many fronts. It does not matter how many ghost AR-15s you have. It doesn't matter if you've got body armor for every member of your family, five layers thick.
Right.
Doesn't matter how deep you build your bunker. You can't avoid it. There's no solution for this other than the one escape policy that Yahweh provided, which is the covenant.
Right. And meanwhile, living, you know, with him through. The only thing harder than getting killed in the Dresden bombing or the Nagasaki bombing or dying in the Holocaust or dying in a famine or or plague is surviving those things.
Right.
You know, we're called to live as though, you know, we are to survive and to live. Right. We're called to live. We're called to survive.
Right. I've got a reason to live. It's not only for my family, but it's also for this message. I've got a reason to live. I'm happy to be gone and rid of the physical body and empowered and enriched and all of the things that are awaiting us. Happy, looking forward to that. But I've got a lot of reasons to live. The covenant is about family. It's about living. It's about sharing. It's about communicating. It's about caring. And so I think we're about doing what we ought to be doing.
Right.
I do want to return to the Iraqi situation, the Syrian situation, for a number of reasons. One is that it is such a screw-up. And every aspect of this was not only predictable, we predicted it right here in this program. But the magnitude of the problem now. Here you've got a city, the third or fourth largest city in Iraq. It was absolutely bludgeoned with American weapons by the Shias that America empowered. And the Sunnis rose up and fought back against them using American weapons. And we've created a civil war because the people we empowered came to abuse those we disempowered. And now we are trying to put the people we empowered that we learned were completely and utterly corrupt and incapable of wielding power morally, civilly. We're now trying to train them and equip them to repulse those that we took out of power. Not recognizing that this is Sunni Islam against Shia Islam, and if you're on the side of the Shia, therefore Iran, you're rowing up a waterfall. It's 80-20. The 20% Shia Muslims are not going to prevail against the Sunni Muslims. America, if there were a right side here, America's on the wrong one. Well, there really isn't a right side. There's two wrong sides.
Right.
But what in the world do we think we're going to accomplish by engaging in a more aggressive way?
Basically, when you sign both sides, it depends on how you feel about the notion of Hegelian dialectic, and fitting. What lets you and him fight with a net result of some sort of synthesis? They also have a cross-border situation where you have Ramadi, and they have Palmyra in Syria, so this could actually end up being a twisted way to, allowing the U.S. to gain entree to a more boots on the ground effort within Syria, leading eventually to the overthrow of Assad.
We did that earlier this week.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I was like, oh, well, we have to go on it gives the excuse to go into Syria on the ground because, it's getting out of hand. Now we've got to go rescue Ramadi and Palmyra.
Hey.
And while we're at it, we may as well go all the way to, to Assad and take him out.
There is no question that the Islamic State is evil. There's no question that Assad is evil. So if you were to go after the Islamic State, then what you're doing is fighting on behalf of Assad. If you go after Assad, then you're going after the most effective enemy of the Islamic State while you're going after the Islamic State. You can't do that. If you were to go after Assad and the Islamic State, then what are you going to do? You're going to occupy Syria so that you can keep it from falling into the same kind of anarchy that Iraq fell into. If you are to fight against the Islamic State in Syria, are you empowering the Iranian Shia, which were just vicious to everyone in Iraq, far more vicious, infinitely more vicious than Saddam Hussein ever was? What are you empowering there? I mean, so, yeah, okay, the Islamic State is bad. So, what are you going to replace it with?
Well, what will ultimately happen is even if the West wanted to displace Assad and put a puppet dictator in, I mean, they're going to have about as much success as they're having in their manipulations in Egypt. You know, it's just going to culturally and demographically blow up in their faces, and eventually you're going to, you know, basically when its critical mass point is reached and Shia Islam is overwhelmed, you're going to end up
right.
A highly militant Sunni Arabic world, you know, Muslim world.
That's going to look at America as the primary enemy. Because we intervened on behalf of the losing side, the Shia. And let's just say that America continues to use the Shia militias and to empower them with weapons and to bomb on their behalf. What are we doing to Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia is wholly opposed to our position in Iraq.
Well, I think eventually, just as the falling apart Roman Empire became weak and we will be marginalized and kicked to the curb. We will become ineffectual in the whole thing, because that's why in the Magog battle, that's why we're on the sidelines. That's why the West is.
We're already worse than ineffectual. When you're as ignorant and as immoral as we have become in terms of foreign policy and the use of one's military, you're counterproductive. And I think America is looked at in Europe and throughout the world as now a counterproductive country, as a country that does more harm than good. And clearly what we're doing in the Islamic world is counterproductive. And so you should kick such countries to the curb. The world would be better off if it were to occur.